The time is now. Volume 7, Episode 139. This is Employment Law Now. I am Mike Schmidt, the host of this podcast and the Vice Chair of the Labor and Employment Department here at Cozen O'Connor. I hope everybody is enjoying what is a short holiday week. This is definitely one of my favorite times of the year. I love this whole Thanksgiving period and between the getting together with family and friends and the food and the football and all of that. It's a great time of year. With that said, we are really trying to condense a whole week's worth of work in just a few days. So I appreciate you taking the time, whenever it is that you're doing it, to listen to this podcast episode, because I think it's really a good one. You know, I truly try very hard in all of these episodes to report down the middle, to be as objective as I can in reporting on labor and employment trends and developments and new cases. But the truth is that here at Cozen O'Connor, I really do only represent the employer side, the management side, when it comes to litigation and advice and counsel on labor and employment issues. So I gave some thought to it, and I thought to myself, wouldn't it be great for the listeners to get some perspective from an attorney who represents the employee side of the equation? How does an employee side attorney think about some of the hot labor and employment law issues, trends, and developments? And what does an employee side lawyer think about or look for when evaluating whether to bring a claim on behalf of her or him against a company? Well, we're going to answer some of those questions today on this episode, because I am so happy to be joined by my colleague in the community and a good friend of mine, Hope Porty. She is the partner at Spivak Lipton LLP in New York. She represents individual employees from low-wage workers to executives in a broad range of workplace issues, including discrimination and harassment, wage and hour violations, terminations, and the negotiation of employment and severance agreements. She litigates all over the place in federal and state court, before administrative agencies, and in arbitration. She also represents unions, as you will hear from her directly say, in various industries, with a particular emphasis on representing creative artists in the entertainment industry. I think you'll enjoy this discussion, and I hope that you gain some valuable insight from it. Hope, it is so great to have you back on the podcast again.
Happy to be here.
So this should be fun. I'm looking forward to this. People out there want to hear, you know, both sides of the story, I think. And for those who are on the company side, on the management side, they are always asking, they want to know, you know, what do the employees look for? What are the lawyers representing the employees look for? What are they thinking about on a lot of these issues? And labor and employment, the great thing about it is there's so many topics to debate. These are real world, practical fact patterns, so much to talk about, so much to debate. And you are such a great person to have these discussions with. So experienced with all of this, you have no opinions whatsoever on any of it. So this should be a little bit of fun. Before we start hitting some of the issues, why don't you tell us a little about your practice and what you focus on?
Absolutely. And I'm very excited to be here and to debate with you some of these issues, Mike. We've done it in the past, and I'm sure we both have some new thoughts on some of these topics. My practice is focused on representing employees and unions in all areas of labor and employment law. On employment matters, I represent a wide range of employees, ranging from low-wage workers, some who do not even earn the minimum wage, to high-end executives at Fortune 500 companies. The matters include wage and hour violations, discrimination claims, employment transition issues, negotiating employment agreements and severance agreements. And then on the labor law side, I represent unions and collective bargaining negotiations, arbitrations, representation elections, and organizing campaigns, internal union governance matters, and unfair labor practice cases. It's a lot of topics to cover in my day-to-day practice. And with respect to the union side practice, I represent employees and unions in all industries, but my firm has a long history representing entertainment unions, and we're known for that somewhat unique representation in that industry.
You and I don't want to date either of us, but we go back almost 30 years already. At this point, we started working together on the opposite sides of a litigation that went to trial, or almost went to trial, and got along swimmingly. So it's been great keeping up with you over these years. And depending on who you talk to, you've either made a successful career on the dark side or on the side of the good. I feel like I'm reading from the script of Wicked all of a sudden. But assuming it was a deliberate choice of yours and not simply happenstance, what made you focus your career on representing employees and that side rather than employers and management?
Yeah, well, certainly I did make a choice. It wasn't happenstance. My intention in going to law school was to be part of community-based movements for social and economic justice. My interest in obtaining a law degree was to position myself to become an executive director or legal director of a not-for-profit organization aligned with those purposes. Along the way, I realized that the empowerment of workers and improvements in the workplace was really the key to effectuating long-lasting social and economic justice and change, as well as improving people's, sense of personal well-being. So I went to work in the labor movement. And as I mentioned, my clients, range from lowest paid workers to the highest paid on the food chain. Yet I realized that there's a common thread in all of those conversations and all that representation is that folks feel, when they call me, it's because they're feeling disempowered or disrespected or devalued in the workplace. And it doesn't really matter where they're slotted in that food chain. And they come to me looking for help, and I try to help them reclaim their power and self-worth and give them a voice to challenge whatever unlawful or unfair or unhealthy workplace practice or policy they feel they've been subjected to.
Yeah, and you've done so many great things for so many people over the years. And it's interesting because I talk to clients all the time, and you use the words disempowered or disenfranchised. So much of what happens in the workplace comes down to communication. Whichever side you're on, and employers tend to feel one way on issues, employees tend to feel another way. But so many things could probably be avoided, if not at least minimized, just by better communication in the workplace. If employees feel as if they're being heard, if they feel they're being, they're a stakeholder in the workplace that they're working in. And we'll get to the unionization movement and the increase in unionization over the last year a little bit later. But I think communication is such a big part in avoiding claims.
I agree with you completely. I think communication and compassion as well, to understand why somebody does not feel like they have a voice in the workplace. And just, Mike, reflecting back on our relationship, one thing that stood out at the time when we were against each other in a lawsuit and has kind of stood the test of time was the compassion that you showed to my clients. It was a discrimination case, as you mentioned, very hard fought litigation. We settled, I think, the morning of the trial, if not, the night before, but, it went to the brink, so to speak. But, my client always felt that you were respectful of him and treated him with, and that also reflected well on your client. But I think you're right. And in labor management relations, that goes a long way, both the communication and the compassion.
So yeah, I appreciate that, of course. I don't know that this episode would be all that fun if we're just going to continue to agree on everything and have a whole love fest here for 45 minutes. So let's hit on some substantive issues and see where we land. I really want to get your perspective on a whole bunch of things. It's not exactly a totally new concept for legislatures or agencies to try to regulate the employer-employee relationship and even agreements that they enter into between them. The question is, on a lot of people's minds, whether the regulation that we're seeing in 2023 has gone too far, or is it not gone far enough as we sit here? A lot of agencies, as you know, have more recently focused on employment-related agreements. The NLRB, and we talk a lot about that agency on this podcast, they've been particularly all over certain provisions in agreements entered into between employer and employee, particularly the general counsel, Jennifer Abruzzo, and particularly in areas like confidentiality and non-disparagement. So let's start there, Hope. Has the NLRB gone too far astray from what many think is its historical core mission?
Well, here we have our first point of disagreement. I do not think that it's gone too far astray. The government agency, the NLRB, as well as other government agencies that are responsible for enforcing statutes that protect workers' rights, that's what the statute is there to do, to protect workers' rights. And what the NLRB is doing at this moment, I think, is making sure that it brings the full protection under that law and making sure that the playing field is leveled and that the workers actually feel able to pursue those rights and, really make sure that employers understand how they need to treat their workers, especially in those areas. Because I think the confidentiality agreements that we're talking, assume what you're getting at, and the non-disparagement agreements, those clauses, they really interfere with workers' rights under the National Labor Relations Act to engage in protected concerted activity. So I think those are very much at the heart and soul of what the NLRB is supposed to be doing.
Well, let's dig into that. And when you talk about the mission, I guess some people view it as a broad mission and some people view it as a narrow mission. And I think it's fair to say that they've gone further in what they're attempting to regulate over the last couple of years than they had, 10, 15, 20 years prior to that. And a common refrain, certainly from management side lawyers, and I might add even from some on the employee side, is that an agency like the NLRB has become way too pro-employee in their guidance, their enforcement initiatives, and their regulation. Oftentimes, perception is reality, and I think that that is at least the perception. The NLRB has become much more pro-employee. What say you?
Well, I think some of these issues the board has touched on for several years. I mean, we've seen the NLRB scrutinizing employment handbooks and policies in those handbooks. And I think, a few years ago, several years ago, we might be sitting here talking about how those, that guidance and the case law that was evolving around those issues actually was favoring employers over employees. So, I mean, I think there's a balance that needs to be struck by the agency. But, again, I think the National Labor Relations Act is intended to protect workers' rights to engage in certain activities. And the reason the statute is there is because the employers hold, most of the power in the workplace. And so the government's there to, kind of lift the voices and level the playing field so that the workers have the ability to actually enforce those rights and be able to engage in, speak freely and act freely in the workplace, as long as it's not too disruptive to the company's, business or other, proprietary interests.
I think that works in many cases. And I think a lot of what you said assumes to a large extent that the employee in a particular situation doesn't have a voice or doesn't have a power to negotiate or to speak on a particular issue. The worry is that you need to protect the vulnerable employees, you said, to protect workers' rights. So why can't we distinguish between situations? Why can't we draw a line when it comes to the enforcement of agreements, for example, between those employees who are represented by a lawyer who give them a voice, who give them a seat at the bargaining, the negotiating table. So we have, on the one hand, agreements that have the lawyers representing employees, and those agreements where the employee did not have any type of representation. So for those who don't have representation, we will heavily scrutinize those provisions, if not outright ban them, when it comes to confidentiality, non-disparagement, or other types of things. But if an employee is represented by a lawyer, does have a voice now, we have no problem with those provisions in a negotiated agreement. What's wrong with drawing that line?
Well, I don't think that line can be drawn so easily. I mean, I don't think you can treat people differently based on whether or not they're represented. I mean, different employees have different levels of sophistication. So I think that comes into play. I mean, if the question is whether or not somebody is truly understanding what they're negotiating, you know, it may or may not matter whether or not there's a lawyer who's representing them. I mean,
depends on the quality of the lawyer, maybe. I mean, maybe that's more a problem with the lawyer you're getting than it is with the employee who's, you know, not the lawyer.
No, I mean, yes. I mean, there's always the issue about quality of representation. But I think, you know, again, we really have to look at what is being protected here, and the confidentiality and non-disparagement clauses shut down workers' rights to talk about terms and conditions in the workplace openly and freely. And that's really what's at the heart of the National Labor Relations Act. And, you know, we know, just looking back to the second Me Too movement, that those types of clauses really had a tremendously negative impact on, you know, rooting out discrimination, sexual harassment. And it really did a disservice to everyone, to obviously the victims of that kind of behavior, but also the workplaces where that behavior was allowed to flourish or persist, because everything was kept, you know, under wraps through these confidentiality clauses and non-disparagement clauses. So, you know, again, I think that's why government agencies have a role in, you know, commenting on these types of provisions and, you know, kind of making it more difficult for these provisions to be put in place, because they don't further the interest of, you know, the public good. And I don't think that they serve the purposes of those particular statutes.
Well, does it? I mean, again, I guess it depends on what the mission really is then. I mean, are we looking to serve the public with a broad stroke, or are we looking to serve the interests of the particular individual, the particular employee? In that case, maybe you have an individual employee who doesn't care about talking freely, who doesn't care about disclosing all of the ills that happened in the workplace. Maybe that individual simply wants money. And so, you know, whether through a lawyer or not, we're going to bargain for some consideration. And, you know, by gutting many of the types of provisions that employers view as worth the dollars they're giving in severance or in some settlement money, whether it's confidentiality or non-disparagement, if we gut those provisions, if we have agencies who say you can't have those provisions across the board anymore, aren't we making it actually less likely that employers might give much needed and much desired severance and other monetary consideration to employees?
Well, I mean, I think employers often want releases, right? That's a great motivator in negotiating these agreements, that employers will secure releases so that the employees won't sue them in any forum once an agreement is reached. So I think that still has a tremendous amount of value and is still an incentive for employers to negotiate these kinds of agreements with their employees. And I think there could be circumstances where, again, if somebody is represented by a lawyer and is actually informed and has a true choice, that you can include a non-disparagement clause or confidentiality clause. I think the problem is that it is very rare for an employer to make a bifurcated offer, because I think, and what I mean by that is to offer something of value in order to get an agreement, maybe with a release, but then to actually maybe offer more money for the confidentiality and non-disparagement clause. I think what happens is it's a take it or leave it approach, and that leaves no room for choice. It's more of a coercive type of negotiation. You'll either get something or nothing. If you want something, you're going to have to take, you know, these two clauses, accept these two clauses, and these are clauses that are stripping you of, you know, federally protected rights. So, I mean, I think that might be one way to strike a balance in order to still allow employers to pursue those types of clauses in these agreements, and allow employees to make the decision, like you said, about whether or not they are willing to give up those rights because they would prefer just to get a certain sum of money.
Yeah, I just don't view it as coercive. I mean, when you talk about coercive, you're talking about, you know, forcing them to enter into agreements to either come to work for you or to continue to work for you. In many of these cases, whether they're severance agreements or settlement agreements, the relationship is going to end in those cases. So I don't know how coercive I view it. You have a choice. You can go ahead and don't release me. Go ahead and sue me. Go ahead and talk about everything that you think was terrible about the workplace. If you don't want to do that and you'd rather 50 grand, I'll give you 50 grand. I mean, I don't know how that's coercive if we're not talking about abusive language and, you know, overbroad provisions. And again, that's where the lawyer comes in. And in most cases, I think employees will tend to have these things reviewed by somebody. But I'm just not sure. I hear you that maybe there's almost like an a la carte option here where we're going to give this amount of money for a release, this amount of money for a confidentiality provision. But I think employers mostly look at it as, hey, we're giving you this whole chunk of money to get back the finality and the certainty that all of these provisions give us and say, look, we're both done with each other. I don't know how that's coercive.
Well, again, it's it goes back to the question you posed. And that was something I was thinking of too, when, preparing for our interview about what purpose is being served. Are we trying to provide a sum of money to an individual? Or are we trying to serve, you know, the public good or the common good to address, you know, unfair practices in the workplace? And I think if we look at the latter, then we can really see the harm that can be done through these confidentiality clauses and these non-disparagement agreements. And again, yes, a person can bargain and decide what they're pursuing, but I work with clients who sometimes would rather have the freedom to speak, you know, out, whether it's on social media or the press or just into their, you know, colleagues and friends, rather than be silenced, because what they're
talking about. Just don't take the big check. They can go, they don't have to be silenced. Go talk to your friends, go stand up and do a press conference, but you don't get both. You don't get the $50,000 and the right to talk.
Well, right. But then it's the same thing from the employer side. The employer has to make a decision as to whether or not if it's worth to enter into an agreement and also to address something. You know, the reason that we're having this discussion is that at least the employee has perceived that they've been treated unfairly. So there's a harm that's been raised, and then the employer needs to decide whether or not it wants to address that harm and how it wants to address that harm. So, the employer also needs to do a little bit of a, you know, conduct its own balancing test as to whether or not it would be enough to, you know, get an agreement and get a release and other things that come with, you know, an agreement. There's a lot of, I know a lot of people look at it as boilerplate legalese, but there are other obligations and commitments that are set forth in those agreements and, deal with the confidential and non-disparagement. I mean, we spent a lot of time negotiating over a lot of these clauses. And from time to time, there may be an employee who really maybe wants to write a book or something like that, or there's a real interest there. But most of the times my clients, once they get to that point, they really never want to have, you know, anything to do with the company. It doesn't even look, you know, well on them necessarily to go out and speak poorly about their prior employer. So I also don't know that there's really that tremendous a risk. And we spent a lot of time discussing and debating and negotiating this language. And I don't really know if it really serves anybody's interest all that much.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. And again, I'm carving out the cases where you're truly taking advantage of an individual, particularly an underrepresented or non-represented individual. There are certainly, to me, the outlier cases. The problem to me is that the board, the NLRB in particular, but government agencies generally seem to be making these rules and these prohibitions across the board in every situation. We know that the NLRB, for example, and these agencies don't have the resources to go after every situation to quote unquote protect the public. We also know that you can't generally in a private agreement prohibit them from going to the agency. Right. So even if I'm getting confidentiality provisions, even if I'm getting non-disparagement provisions, you can't typically say you're not allowed to go to the NLRB or name your agency. So in that case, despite the check that they receive in cash, despite the provisions they've entered into, they still go to government agency. And if government agency wants to, it can go after the employer to protect the quote unquote public. So I just have a hard time seeing how this regulating across the board these provisions in a private employment agreement setting is stifling the public's ability to get the benefit of the mission of these agencies.
Yeah. And I mean, I think also one thing that's important to keep in mind, too, is that the NLRB is regulating the relationships between, you know, statutory employees, how that term is defined under the statute. So it excludes supervisory managerial employees. So it is a certain subset of the employees and really targeted more at the group I think you're talking about, you're characterizing as more vulnerable employees, whereas, you know, these, recent pronouncements and guidance don't necessarily affect the individuals who perhaps are going to be represented by lawyers and, you know, are in a different, you know, work in a different capacity at a different level and may be able to be better positioned to negotiate these clauses in a more informed way and more voluntarily. You know, but the one thing just with respect to, again, the confidentiality and NDA, I always think about the, you know, FLSA, the Fair Labor Standards Act, where, you know, there are claims litigated regarding wage and hour violations, and by statute, those, and by case law, right, there cannot be confidentiality clauses made a part of any settlement agreement. So there's a lot of transparency around employers who commit wage and hour violations or alleged to have committed wage and hour violations and settle those claims. And I mean, I don't see any great, you know, a different kind of damage or different kind of interest there that I think employers seem to be able to withstand having those agreements made public. So I'm not sure why in other areas of law we have such a grave concern about not being able to utilize confidentiality clauses in NDAs freely.
Yeah, that is a great point. And I think the flip side of that is, why are we treating some claims and allowing confidentiality, but in other types of cases like the FLSA, there's a much more rigorous process that you have to go through to reach a settlement. And in those cases, you generally can't even have confidentiality. But so I want to move away from confidentiality and non-disparagement provisions and talk about this issue of regulation of only certain issues, but not others. And is that inherently missing the point here? So the OWBPA, the Older Workers Benefit Protection Act, which as everybody, of course, knows, is the amendment to the ADEA, the Age Discrimination and Employment Act, that requires for terminated employees who are 40 years of age or older, that you now add specific language to get an enforceable age discrimination release, whereas in contrast, you don't have to give that same language to non-age releases. So, right, so for 40 and over, you got to give them 21 days to consider the agreement, 45 if it's part of a group termination. Then they have a 7-day window within which that they can revoke it. And this is only for age release claims. You don't have that if you're releasing disability discrimination claims or race discrimination claims. And some might argue the irony of that is that you actually are discriminating based on age and that you are making assumptions about older individuals who need this process that you're not making for those who are younger than 40. You agree with that? You agree there's an irony there?
I think it's an interesting point. I think every agreement should have a 21-day review period and a 7-day revocation period. I often advocate for that when employees are confronted with an agreement that doesn't have that kind of clause. And I always raise with the employer attorneys, look, I think you're putting your release at risk because, yes, by the letter of the agreement, it says that, you know, it doesn't provide for that kind of review period. But, you know, in order for someone to really make an informed choice, then they really need some more time than 24 hours, 48 hours, which I've seen in some agreements. So, you know, my answer to your question, the point that you raise is to let's make that mandatory for every single agreement that contains a release.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting. I don't know that I have a problem with that. I think I'd rather see that across the board than this. To me, it doesn't make really a lot of sense that we're requiring the review and requiring the process for people we're considering to be older people. And for the younger folks, we think that they can all of a sudden make an informed choice in 24 hours. The irony is striking there. Arbitration is sort of similar in that respect, that we have been so far regulating the use of arbitration and arbitration agreements only in certain types of cases. So arbitration agreements have been the subject of a lot of debate and news. Many companies like them primarily because they keep the more, I guess, salacious or newsworthy allegations out of the public courthouse. If employees are not prevented from having their claims fully heard and from otherwise obtaining all remedies they could otherwise get in court, and you and I don't think have spoken about this, so I'm interested in your take on it. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with having an arbitration agreement if an employee's true motivation isn't simply to use the press or media to put pressure on the employer, and they're going to otherwise be entitled to all the remedies they could get in court?
Yeah, well, I know we were trying to move away from the conversation about confidentiality, but I think it goes, you know, goes right to that point that arbitrations are a more private process. And by forcing employees to go through an arbitration process, you are essentially silencing those employees about talking freely about their terms and conditions of employment. So I think that's problematic. And I think that the employees often have to sign those arbitration agreements at the onset of employment. And, you know, that's at a period of time where one, employees don't really feel that they're able to challenge, you know, any sort of condition that's placed on them at the beginning of the employment, nor would they probably have the choice to opt out of a, you know, a program that an employer may have to mandate arbitration. So I think that there's, again, a lack of, you know, true consent and real informed decision making. I wouldn't have a problem if once an issue has emerged and there's some sort of conflict that arises, an employee comes forward to make a complaint, that there's an option to go through arbitration. And if the employee chooses to use arbitration at that time and everybody mutually agrees, I think that would be fine. It may be a very appropriate process. I mean, I find a lot of clients, you know, they hesitate about filing in court, even if they have a very strong claim, because employees often don't want the publicity as well. Because as we all know, you can Google somebody's name and a case that's been filed on a docket, on a court docket, is easily retrievable. And that person, if they're complaining about something has happened to them in the workplace, it's very possible that a future employer is going to hesitate about hiring that person. So, you know, I don't know if employees, it depends. It's going to be an individual choice. But again, it should be a true choice rather than something that's imposed at the onset of employment when you really don't know what may happen, what that claim may look like, you know, why it may make a difference to go to court versus going to an arbitration.
And your view, if somebody said, well, there is a choice that you don't have to take that job if you don't like the contract that they're offering you in terms of an arbitration agreement. That's where your choice is. You don't have to take the job.
Well, that is a choice by definition. I will agree with you. That is a choice. But, you know, most of us need to work. Most of us don't have multiple, you know, opportunities for employment. And so that is something that's not an easy take it or leave it kind of situation. If you've now landed the job, you know, the job of your dreams, or a job you need to pay the rent or the mortgage. And now you're being asked to sign away your rights. I don't call that, you know, true voluntary choice.
Yeah. And look, I don't want to leave the impression, because I don't feel this way, that there are not benefits to the sort of public discourse that comes out of a lot of these claims. There's no question that the Me Too movement, which is a great example and a recent example of how you've affected change in companies, in society, frankly, because women have been able to speak out on these issues, and women who may have been previously bound to non-disclosure and confidentiality agreements have now been told, no, you can talk about what happened to you. You can talk about what was wrong. And from that, we're effectuating change and improvement in workplaces around the country. I think that's a great thing. There's no question about that. The question becomes, though, and I think really the point I'm just trying to make is this across the board this across-the-board regulation or regulation that is just discriminatorily picking which issues it's okay to not have publicized. And issues where, you know, we want to have it be able to be publicized. I mean, where in Title VII, if you have an age discrimination claim, a race discrimination claim, where in Title VII does it give you the right to say, I'm entitled to go to a press conference and talk about this and air all of my grievances? Where is that a remedy in Title VII?
Well, I mean, you could argue under the National Labor Relations Act that somebody who's speaking out about terms and conditions of employment, and when those terms and conditions have to do with a discriminatory workplace or a place where there's, you know, harassment of any nature taking place, that they're speaking out, you know, not only on behalf of themselves, but on behalf of others in that workplace.
And I gave you a loophole. I gave you an easy one. So I'm a supervisor then. Let's forget about the National Labor Relations Act. Pretend I'm a supervisor with a race discrimination claim. Where in Title VII do I have a right to go and have a press conference and air my grievances?
Well, you have, I mean, I believe embedded in that statute is the right to have it decided in a, you know, certainly in open court, by a jury of your peers to determine whether or not there's been discrimination, harassment, and a court proceeding is a public proceeding. So the fact that you are also perhaps speaking to the press, I don't think that's too much of a stretch. I mean, again, I don't think that there's certainly nothing in any of those laws that allows the employers to force, you know, arbitration through those, you know, statutes. That's been a hotly debated issue. But I do think that implicit in enforcing those rights, those very important rights, that they are to be aired publicly. And, you know, in thinking about what we'd be discussing here, and as we see that the theme of confidentiality keeps reemerging, I was reminded of something that a judge said to me recently in a First Amendment case that I was handling during a settlement process where the employer was arguing very, you know, strongly for a very broad confidentiality clause. And the judge, you know, quoted to me from Judge Justice Brandeis, who is a Supreme Court justice, a famous quote of his. It's, if the broad light of day could be let in upon men's actions, it would purify them as the sun disinfects. And he was commenting on the right to publicity in order to actually protect individuals, and especially individuals who have been subjected to unlawful behavior, and that by shielding these types of actions, that you actually let people, employers as it may be, that basically appear as if they're doing the right thing. So I think that's something, you know, to consider in all of this, that if, again, it goes back to the question we posed earlier, if we're really trying to affect the common good, then having these practices exposed will deal with the immediate harm, but they also set examples for everybody else. And, you know, some employers showcase, you know, what they're doing, especially, you know, in discrimination, harassment, you know, they're more than willing to put out there, you know, in the public, in the press, you know, policies and practices they have, EDI programs, affinity, you know, all the things that employers are doing. And that sets an example for others. So, I mean, the same way in, I think, enforcing individuals' rights and bringing cases and having court decisions guide employers as to what is, well, there's a right way of about going, you know, the right way of doing these things and the wrong way of handling these issues. I think that is tremendously impactful and really serves the true purpose of a lot of the statutes that we're talking about.
Yeah, and it's a great point. That's a great quote. I appreciate you you mentioned that. It really is a great quote. I think the easier cases are when you have an alignment of interest with the employee and the greater public. You know, put aside the employer's interest for a moment. I think to me, you probably have a far better case when the employee's interest in a particular case is aligned with protecting the public. To me, it goes too far. Again, putting aside the management side issue or the side of the equation, when, you know, you're trying to promote the public good or promote some interest that the public may have, at the expense of what the individual employee herself or himself may want in that particular case. And again, it may just be as simple as, you know, I want severance for a longer period of time. I'm okay giving up this right and that right You know, I'd love to do great for the public, but I don't really care about the public. I want the finality and I want my money now. And I'm represented by a lawyer, a great lawyer who went to a great law school and is doing a good job negotiating for me. I should be able to have my own private agreement, even if it may not be in that case, the one that is going to protect all of the public good forever.
Yeah,
I mean, I think that's where my issue is, you know, is in that scenario.
Yeah. And I mean, again, I think there's ways to do it. I mean, I had the one suggestion, you know, doing these bifurcated offers to show that there's true value and consideration and
a la carte agreement.
A la carte agreement. We're going to start. Our friends across the bar are going to start hearing that from us. Let's talk about an a la carte agreement.
That's great. We'll give you 2 for 1. We'll give you, you know, we'll, for half price. We're running a sale here. Buy a confidentiality and a release. 2 for 1.
Or you mean in New York, you know, you have the, you know, the legislature enacted the process by which, you know, if you want to get a sexual harassment discrimination case, if you want to get in a confidentiality agreement or NDA, you have to provide that additional time period and have a standalone agreement to memorialize that, to really capture the fact that there was a true negotiation around those provisions. I think with the, you know, probably what the NLRB is grappling with, I mean, I shouldn't speak for the NLRB, but I mean, I think one of the issues, again, it's the coercion aspect, and it does seem like it's a take it or leave it. And you're right. I mean, I think there's something to distinguish between a severance agreement where there may not be an actual legal claim under one of these statutes. You know, I think that's something different. There's other things that are coming into play. I mean, I negotiate a lot of those agreements. There's a lot of things that are coming into play other than actual, you know, statutorily protected rights. So, I could see our way of separating out those types of claims, but where it's, you know, claims that a person has that they can pursue under one of those statutes. And so they really are giving up something that's embedded in a federal law or state or city law, that they're, should be value attached to that. And I think that needs to be negotiated openly, and the employee needs to have a real choice about whether or not to give that up. And the employer has to be, again, has to do its own evaluation about whether or not it's really worth it to them, you know, and figure out how much money that they, you know, the claim is worth, the situation is worth, to bring that finality that they're looking for. But again, you know, a release is a very valuable thing. So I still think that there's going to be motivation for employees and employers to work out these situations and negotiate agreements.
Well, is that where we're heading? I mean, if we're going to look at, and I know we're being a little facetious with the a la carte menu for agreement provisions, but are government agencies going to start dictating what the value is in order for them to be not coercive? So in order to get a confidentiality and non-disparagement provision, you've got to give X dollars or X months of severance. In order to get a valid release, you got to pay them this much. I mean, you think we're going to go that route?
I hope not. It makes it very hard to market ourselves as good lawyers.
True.
We'll be like, we're turned into workers' comp lawyers, right? An arm is worth this amount of money, legs worth this amount of money. So I don't know. Maybe we have to fine tune that a la carte option a little bit. But we'll yeah, I would agree that would be, I think, overreaching to assign those values. Yeah.
All right, let's get back to something we don't agree on. Or maybe we do, I don't know. But another agreement, as long as we're talking about agreements, and I've got a whole host of rapid-fire, hot-issue questions in true-false format that I want to get to. But just to finish up talking about agreements, another one that seems to be at risk of extinction are non-compete agreements. You know, sure, I think we can all agree that there are definitely extreme cases where the lowest level of employee, the most vulnerable employee, shouldn't be tied to a non-compete agreement. And we've seen that and heard that in the news of companies, and I won't, you know, name them necessarily, who are, to your point, putting coercive, one-sided, non-negotiated agreements in front of these low-wage earners who are forced to accept these, not knowing what the ramifications are, in order to get these, in many cases, low-paying jobs. And I get that. You know, we don't want to have non-compete agreements when there's no business interest or a ridiculously overbroad one. I think we can all agree. But when we're now talking about the issue in the context of, on the federal side, the FTC looking to ban them across the board outright with no exception, when you have states like New York that is currently proposing effectively an outright ban on them, regardless of industry, regardless of position, pay, all of that, is banning non-compete agreements outright the appropriate measured response in order to protect those situations where you are protecting the abused or the vulnerable employee? Is an outright ban something that you'd want to see?
Is this part of the true or false?
No, I'm going to let you, I'll let you give an answer before I ask the judge to direct you to, limit your answer to my question. No, it's a conceptual thing. I'm not even sure, frankly, that non-compete agreements are really employer versus employee issues, because I think, there are some employers out there that don't like non-compete agreements. It's not that they're just using them for their own employees, but when they're hiring and bringing people in, they've got to deal with the enforceability of agreements that another employer gave to the employee that we're now trying to bring on. So I'm not really convinced this is a true employee-employer issue, but I do want your perspective on whether you think an outright ban is the appropriate response to the situations where employees are being abused in some cases by non-compete agreements.
I do not think there should be non-compete clauses that are enforceable when an employee is terminated from employment, whether it's by layoff, whether it's with cause, without cause. But if an employer decides that they no longer want to employ an individual for any reason, I don't think that they should be allowed to impose or enforce a non-compete. So to the extent that, whether it's by the federal government or by other statute, I think that would certainly be an appropriate ban. I mean, that's where the cases are headed that way. So it would be consistent with how the law is evolving. But would you agree with that, Mike?
Yeah, I think on one level, by terminating somebody without cause, whether it's, a reorganization, a restructuring, you don't, love their performance, or it's just not a great fit, in many cases, that's a little inconsistent then with saying, well, I've got to keep this person off the street because I'm losing something with my business by them leaving. I mean, if you thought they were that valuable, if you thought that they were, promoting some legitimate business interest of your company, presumably you wouldn't have let them go. So I do get, the notion on one level that if you're terminating an employee without cause, you shouldn't necessarily be able to turn around and bar them from going out and working. Trade secret issues aside, of course, but just a ban and a non-competes. And I do agree again as well that there are instances where you probably should be restricting the use of non-competes. I think there are certainly levels of employee positions. I think geographic and temporal scope is something that probably could be regulated. But what we're seeing, again, on the federal level and in some, more local jurisdictions are this push to outright ban them. And I guess that's my issue, is to just indiscriminately say, I don't care how senior an executive the person is. I don't care what the industry is. You just can't use non-competes, period.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you're right with respect to the geographic and temporal proximity. I mean, temporal proximity is pretty easy to negotiate around. I mean, I think, and I am starting to see, a few years ago, several years ago, you would have non-compete clauses of 2+ years in duration. And now I'm starting to see, a little bit more frequently 6 months, a year max. Not that I don't see a 2-year, but I think the problem though with geographic proximity, with respect to how businesses operate on a global, scope, and also with e-commerce, that it gets very difficult. We're not talking about, there's the physician who has leaving a medical practice. That's very easy to figure out how to draw lines where that person at least is not competing for the same patients, but could still go ahead and practice medicine somewhere in the vicinity of where they live. But I think it's making it very difficult to rationally define the appropriate geographic scope for non-compete clauses, for most businesses. So I think those become very problematic. I mean, I think the other issue is with non-compete clauses, even if it was appropriate to impose a non-compete clause because that particular individual really presents a risk to a company's business interests, perhaps, you know, a salesperson or someone who, you know, an inventive, you know, person who holds important trade secrets, that for whatever period of time that non-compete runs, they, it should not even be a question that they should receive severance for that entire period of time. And that is something I still do not see a lot. And it, you know, we negotiate around it, but that seems to me just would be, you know, just a basic principle. If you're going to keep that person out of the marketplace for a year, let's say, then you should provide them with severance for a year. Otherwise, you've put them in a very difficult economic position. I mean, even, you know, executives who are high earners, you cut someone off for a paycheck for 6 months and potentially, you know, health benefits. You don't know if they're the, you know, provider for the head provider for their family or whatever it might be. That puts that person in a really difficult financial circumstances. And, you know, you also have issues with respect to equity that come up now with, you know, where people have negotiated employment agreements with deferred compensation. And if they're terminated early, they don't realize that they haven't gotten the benefit of their, you know, the compensation they thought they negotiated. So again, being kept out of the marketplace for an extended period of time can really create a tremendous, you know, financially difficult situation for someone, even if they appear to have the wherewithal to, you know, be out of work for a few months or, you know, I guess they could go work in a completely different job, but, you know, that's very difficult.
Yeah, I think I agree with you in virtually everything you just said. I mean, the takeaway is, you know, maybe we don't just outright ban non-competes indiscriminately, but let's sit down and have a discussion about when they should be used and what are the conditions that we need to impose if they are going to be used. You know, much like you said, are we going to pay for all or a portion of the restricted period? How are we going to define geographic temporal scopes, you know, notice provisions, all those kinds of things? Let's at least have a discussion about how we want to limit them. But maybe an outright ban is not the way to go. All right. So we've reached the point of the podcast where we are at the true false segment. Hope, I know you've been looking forward to this as our listeners have been as well. We're at the true false part of our podcast episode, and the category is wage and hour. The category is wage and hour. Another hot issue these days around the country is the focus on wages from a lot of different angles, and I want to get your reaction to a few of them. I'm going to apologize in advance for putting you on the spot. I'm not going to say I don't mean to, because that's exactly what I mean to be doing. I mean to be putting you on the spot now. So here we go. Number one, raising the minimum wage will actually more likely promote employees being fired or not getting hired. True or false, Hope?
False.
I mean, I don't want to start you off by saying that was the wrong answer, but tell me why that's false. Tell me why that's false.
Well, first of all, we're seeing that there's a tremendous demand for labor and that employers are already increasing wages in order to attract labor. So, and going way above the minimum wage. So I think that's one showing that the minimum wage is not a sufficient wage to actually attract, you know, workers. And so for that reason alone, and I think also there's a tremendous amount of research that has been done on this issue and has clearly established that raising the minimum wage does not, it does not create a rationale for employers to reduce hiring or to fire employees, that they can withstand those incremental increases.
Okay, wage and hour for 300. Wage transparency laws, Hope. Certainly having the laudatory goal of eliminating historical inequity when it comes to the wages of women, minorities, and other historically underrepresented groups. But wage transparency laws as they exist now will not accomplish their goals. True or false?
False.
Ugh. Why is that? Why is that false?
This is actually an area where I have seen almost an immediate positive impact, because for so long, employees did not know what other people were making. And the employers held all the power, and they actually created a culture where employees should not be talking about their wages. I mean, obviously in unionized environments, there's transparency about how much people are earning. But, you know, as we know, unfortunately, there's a very large sector of the workforce that's not unionized and doesn't have access to that kind of information. and it has allowed there to be discriminatory pay practices and, you know, other issues that have factored into setting wage rates. And now that employees have, you know, there's these pay transparency laws so that employees know exactly what the wages are for any particular position. I think that has really shed a light, maybe going back to Justice Brandeis, you know, that it has really, I think, it has really allowed employees to know their worth and to know what other people are making and to empower them to make sure that they're being valued appropriately and not for impermissible reasons.
Yeah, it's a great point. And I agree with you. And again, where I tend to agree with you most is, you know, whether when the goal that you're trying to accomplish is accomplished through some, you know, reasonably tailored regulation. Where I start to have the issue is when we start going, you know, really overbroad and imposing burdens and not really accomplishing at the end of the day what we were seeking to. So the salary history ban laws, I agree completely. I think that, you know, they've got a great purpose in trying to eradicate this perpetual pay discrimination, particularly, you know, with women and minorities, that if you're going to continue to base your salary in a new job on what they were making in their past jobs where there may have been pay inequity, you're just going to perpetuate that. So, you know, I think that those laws have a really good purpose behind them. When you start talking about the other kinds of salary transparency laws and requiring, you know, job postings and job salary ranges, you know, you start getting a little bit, in my opinion, overbroad in some respects and placing administrative burdens on companies, particularly when you're talking about posting jobs that can be held in this era of remote work, and the job can be held across or notwithstanding state jurisdictional lines. And, you know, now you're going to have to post a different range for the job if someone's going to take it in Montana versus someone's going to take it in New York City versus, you know, Boise, Idaho. Is that really accomplishing what you're intending to accomplish with those kinds of laws? I'm not sure that they always do.
Well, again, I mean, I think the transparency really creates a level playing field. I mean, not only for the incoming employees who are, you know, the applicants, so that they understand what that salary band is and they can compare it, you know, in the market. It's also with respect to existing employees, because if you have pay practices that are not fair within your existing workforce, then, you know, that's going to be revealed when you start posting these jobs publicly. And I think, and, you know, Mike, you're better positioned to be able to comment on this, that I think these pay transparency laws are probably causing employers to do their internal pay audits so that they really understand how they've been setting wage rates. If there's any kind of disparities that are not justifiable, they're able to make those corrections and adjustments. A lot of time, you know, sometimes existing employees get bumps because they now realize that it may be because of historical disparities that had nothing to do with that employer, but somebody was discriminated against at a past job. And unfortunately, that's carried through with them. And then, you know, once those internal corrections are made, posting that job going forward, hopefully you're not going to see as much, you know, disparities that are, again, unjustifiable. So I think it has a benefit going forward. But yes, of course, there's going to be administrative expenses, but those seem to be, you know, appropriate expenses to try to address these issues.
All right. So wage an hour for 500. Hope the overtime exemptions are ridiculous as they are now stated. The job duties tests are not workable, lead to all kinds of litigation, and the salary thresholds that are applied regardless of industry or geography are nonsensical. True or false?
True.
Wow. True. Why do you think it's true?
Well, I think it's one. I mean, I don't think the salary thresholds are reasonable based on, you know, by trying to create, you know, determine who's going to be exempt from overtime, who's not going to be exempt from overtime. The salary threshold's low enough that, you know, an employer could put somebody who's, you know, still a pretty low level, you know, not a high level employee, high level managerial, a supervisory employer, administrative employee, and then work them to death, basically. With respect to, you know, working over 40 hours a week and not have to pay them overtime. So I think the low salary thresholds don't create the deterrent that they were supposed to create in terms of allowing employers to get away from paying overtime. I think they're also just very complicated for employees to understand. And a lot of people also, I think a lot of employers know about the threshold, but then they don't know about the duties test. So they set the wage rate and then they think they can work people, you know, that they're automatically exempt. And that duties test just gets kind of tossed to the wayside if people even are aware it's there. And then in New York, we have an anomaly that you have, you know, the other thing is you have different salary thresholds, federal and state level in New York, at least. And then in New York, you don't have the professional employees who are necessarily subject to the salary threshold. So it's a very complicated framework for something I think that, you know, employees should be able to clearly understand if they're overtime eligible or not. And employers should be able to make those determinations pretty easily. So I think I agree with you that something needs to be done to simplify the framework so it's more clearly understood by employees and employers.
Final Jeopardy question. Employees should be able to say anything they want about employers over social media as long as it's not during work time, true or false?
As long as it does not rise to the level of defamation.
Because that's so well defined.
Well, it is. There is a legal definition and a legal cause of action for defamation. So I would not want to in any way encourage any employee to violate an existing law. But I think employees should be free to speak out. And employers also have that right to speak out. And, you know, again, when we talk about, you know, a level playing field and who holds the power, employers are probably better able to leverage the press and media to address any claims that are unwarranted. But I don't think employees should be restricted. And I think it could get very subjective about what might be, you know, too much or what might be disparaging or derogatory or, you know, however you might determine which speech is permissible and what speech isn't permissible.
Well, and we have anti-discrimination and anti-harassment and anti-retaliation laws on the books. Why shouldn't an employer be able to decide, it's their business, why shouldn't they be able to decide, hey, what you're saying, what you're doing is inconsistent with our business, with our core business. Why can't they say that? And in that respect, you know, take some sort of adverse action against activity or statements.
Well, I think if employees do say or do anything that's inconsistent with an employer's discrimination, you know, non-discrimination, anti-harassment policies, and even bullying policies that a lot of employers have now, then I think they should be able to take action. I think that's a more strict scrutiny type of analysis.
But not just that they're violating the policies. I'm sorry to interrupt, but what they're saying and what they're doing, admittedly off hours, off premises, their conduct, their statement is inconsistent with our business motto, our business's mission, the type of clients that we use or have. Why can't I be able to fire an employee for saying or doing something I don't like when I think it's contrary to my business interests?
Well, I mean, off duty, you know, when people are off duty, they're off duty. The employers don't own the employees and aren't able to regulate everything that they say or do away from the workplace. So I think we've seen instances where the case, you know, involving, I'm thinking though in Central Park, the woman who called the police when she got this situation with the two individuals in Central Park. And I believe she was fired and challenged that. And I believe that was upheld because I think it was because the employer was able to demonstrate that she acted inconsistent with the non-discrimination anti-harassment policies because she had engaged in racist behavior. So, I think there's, you know, I don't think that employers don't have any options in those situations if they can draw a clear nexus between that off-duty, you know, off-site workplace or, you know, that conduct outside of the workplace and a nexus between either the business interest or a business policy.
All right. So, I mean, we are getting, it's hard to believe that we're almost at an hour already. This has been so great. I love doing this. I have two last questions that I wanted to make sure I got to. One of the things we all agree on, I think, is that there has been a substantial rise in unionization. over the past year at least. And we're sort of coming a little full circle because we talked about this a bit in the beginning of this episode. We're talking about communication and all of that. What do you attribute the substantial rise, assuming you agree with that, what do you attribute the substantial rise in unionization, particularly in 2023 that we've seen? What do you think is the cause of that?
Well, I think employees are feeling more empowered to demand better working terms and conditions. And I also think they're feeling very frustrated about terms and conditions that they've been working under for so long. And I think COVID certainly was a catalyst in this regard, where workers felt that their safety and health was not being prioritized by companies. And I think that really kind of propelled people to speak up and organize no matter what, because so much was at stake. I think also advances in technology, social media has made it much easier for employees to communicate with one another about their concerns and organize within their workplace. You no longer have to have a hushed conversation by the water cooler. A lot of workers, they don't socialize outside the office. So the only time they have to really talk to one another is in their workplaces. This again is, before the emergence and popularity of the remote work situation. So having all these different social media channels just made it much easier for people to voice their concerns and then feel that they could actually bring those concerns to their employers. And, they're organizing either through formal union organizing movements, organizing campaigns, or they're creating affinity groups or other types of employee groups. You see that more in the tech industry, where they haven't formally unionized, but, they've been able to, band together and engage in protected concerted activity. So I think, those are certainly a lot of things that are motivating the employees to, get involved with the labor movement and organize in different ways.
And people were saying, the unions were dead at some point. I remember hearing that, before 2023, and quite the contrary. I mean, is there one particular issue that you think is leading employees to want to seek the representation that unions give? Is it wages? Is it workplace health safety? Is it they're just feeling like their voices are not being heard? Is it all of the above?
I would say I'm hearing and seeing safety and health as being a galvanizing issue for sure. Like I mentioned with respect to COVID, I can talk a little bit about there was a big negotiation, potential strike in Hollywood about a year ago. And some of the, the long hours, safety and health risks driving home on, dark streets after working a 16-hour day on a movie set. I mean, these are the kinds of issues I think that people feel that they're just pushed to the brink, that it's not necessarily the economic issues, but it's where they're actually feel that their lives are at stake. And so I think that's a big issue. I think discrimination, harassment is also a really big issue. And people are seeing unions as more of a vehicle for advancing those causes in the workplace. Economics are always going to be a part of the equation when you're talking about employees getting together and pushing for better terms and conditions. But it's not, when I meet with workers who are looking to organize, that's not the number one issue. It's much more about health, safety, respect, and a voice in the workplace. I think and that shouldn't be minimized at all. I think the idea that people, as you know, they're stakeholders, people, we spend a lot of time at work, and people want to feel like they're able to have a say and have a voice. And I think that's off, having a union is something that really allows people to have that voice in the workplace. And so that's why I think people are attracted to, joining the labor movement.
Yeah, it's fascinating and such a great point you make. We can have differences of opinions, management side and the employee side. But what I like to think there shouldn't be disagreement on is that there should be communication in the workplace, that everybody is a stakeholder and everyone who is a stakeholder, should have some voice in how things are going when it affects the workplace. It may not be every suggestion getting accepted or taken, but, everybody should be able to have some voice. There should be communication. Hope, I've got the last question here before I thank you and end this episode. And I think this is really something that will be most helpful, certainly for those on the employer side to understand, and particularly those employers who want to do the right thing by their employees. So without giving away too much in the way of your trade secrets, what are some of the things that you think about as an employee side lawyer? Some of the things that you look at when a company's employee comes to you with a case or a claim to potentially bring against a current or former employer, what are the red flags that you look for to say, hey, there's a potential claim here, we're going to go forward, or you know what, the company seems to have been doing things right, may not be worth it to take this case. What are you looking for when someone comes in your door?
I mean, the first thing I'm looking to hear is to really discern whether or not there's unlawful behavior that has happened. And by that, I mean a violation of an existing federal, state, or city statute. So determine whether or not we actually have a potential lawsuit on our hands. And that will take us down a certain path in terms of bringing claims to a government agency or into court and having those conversations. I'm also looking to hear, you know, get all of the employment background information, but I want to find out about the company culture, how and if that person has felt valued by the company. And if they haven't, what has caused them to feel that way? Because that, you know, that usually gets at some of the things that don't necessarily support a claim being brought in court to a government agency, but it's a reason that this person has come to me, and I can figure out if there's something I can do as a lawyer to help them navigate that situation. And then I really try to understand the client's expectations and desired outcome. And this kind of relates to our conversation about arbitration versus court. Most people come to me no matter if they have a true legal claim that we could file in court or if there's something else going on. They don't want to sue their employers. It takes, you know, resources, you know, it takes financial resources. It takes a tremendous amount of, you know, mental and emotional resources. And there's also a risk to their professional reputation. And most people, again, it goes back to what we're talking about, feeling people want to feel valued and respected. And so we talked about compassion goes a long way. And so we try, you know, I'm trying to really listen to them to figure out what it is they want. Cause sometimes I feel like that's a great case. Like, yes, like that is like discrimination 101. Let's file. I'll get, you know, I can get this filed. And they're like, and that's not what I'm hearing that they really want. They just want to, they either need to get out of the situation because it's not healthy for them. And then we think about how can we approach the employer in order to do that in a way that's, you know, respectful and really serves both the employee's interest and the employer's interest, but yet doesn't trigger a termination or something like that. So it's balancing all those different needs, really. And most importantly, I'm trying to figure out what it is that the client really wants in the situation. And usually it's somewhat the path of least resistance in terms of just trying to find a way out of a difficult situation.
And that's a great way to end. Hope Porty at Spivak Lipton in New York. This has been such a great conversation with a great lawyer and advocate, and of course a great friend as well. And I am so appreciative of staying in touch over the 30 some odd years, again, without dating ourselves. But thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Not easy. I'm hitting you with all these questions and true and false nonsense, but you've answered them really well and perfectly, and I really appreciate your perspective, and hopefully the listeners have as well.
Well, thank you, Mike. I love listening to your podcast. It helps me stay on top of all the developments in labor and employment law, and it's always a great opportunity to exchange ideas with folks on the other side, and very interesting to hear where we agree and where we disagree, but I always appreciate the conversations with you, and you're a great colleague, even if you have been working on the dark side for quite a while.
I was hoping to end with a compliment, but that's I'll take that as well. I appreciate it too, and hope to do this again another time. Thank you, Hope.
I am so grateful that Hope spent so much time with us on this episode. There were still so many issues, so many topics I would have loved to get to, but I'll save that for the next time. And until the next time, I hope all of you have a wonderful Thanksgiving, a healthy and happy holiday season as we come close to closing out 2023. And I also hope that all of your labor is productive.